Here's a few quick notes about the show. Southern Girl Crime Stories is a podcast focused mostly on lesser-known true crime cases that range from murders, missing persons, cold cases, soft cases, and more. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, locations of murders, and more. Avery Vernie Shorts, who went by the nickname Peaches, was born to Elwood Shorts and Hazel Smith on May 18, 1974. In 1980, 6-year-old Peaches was a kindergarten student living in South Knoxville, Tennessee. On Friday, December 26, 1980, Peaches walked to a nearby convenience store called the Pantry Market and purchased a 16-ounce soft drink from the store clerk, Clara Coleman. After buying her drink, she was seen walking home on Joe Lewis Road, but would sadly never make it and was never seen alive again. Clara said that Peach was a regular and would always carry a piece of paper with her that she called her shopping list. She was known for coming by the store every day between 3 and 5 p.m. When her mother, 25-year-old Hazel, realized her daughter should have already been home, she went to the store to look for her. That's when Clara told her that she had been there and left around 5 p.m. Hazel then reported her daughter missing at 5:48 p.m., and nearly 300 officers, rescue workers, other volunteers, and tracker dogs split into 4 groups to search for her. These searches also included 2 nearby quarries. During the search, they found a pair of children's pants and a soft drink, but Hazel said they didn't belong to Peaches. Investigators theorized that she was most likely abducted while walking home and forced into a car. When Hazel was asked who might have done this, she told them about a man named Mitchell Arville Webb, who had been trying to convince her to go on a date with him for the last 6 months. Webb had a past criminal record and would get arrested in 1983, 3 years after Peach's disappearance. That arrest was for the robbery of an appliance rental store, and he was subsequently sentenced to 20 years in prison. Before Peach's disappearance, he was convicted of 11 different felonies dating back to 1957. However, all those crimes were property-related and not sexual or violent crimes. Regardless, Webb had actually threatened Hazel before Peach's disappeared. He and Hazel had met in the summer of 1980, but she never went on a date with him because he was 22 years older than she was. That same summer they met, he drove her to a Kmart department store and offered to buy her what she wanted. So she picked out a couple of outfits, a bathing suit, and a camera. She was only able to wear the clothes once because they were stolen after being washed and hung on a clothesline. As for the camera, she said she threw it away. When Webb found out, he was pissed and began telling her he was going to get even with her. When he came by on the 26th of December, she asked him to buy her a soft drink. While he refused to go get it, he left her some change on the counter. But before leaving, he asked her to move in with him, but she said she would have to think about it for about a week first. He didn't like having to wait and became upset, stormed out, and slammed the door behind him. After leaving her apartment, he drove to the Pantry Market, bought a cup of coffee, and stood outside sipping it. Peaches left to go to the same store at 3:30 p.m. However, she didn't arrive at the store until about 4:30 because she stopped to play with some friends. When investigators went to speak with Webb, he said he never saw Peaches at the store. He said after drinking his coffee, he drove to Central Street to shoot dice, but could never find his friends to play. He then began driving around the area when he decided to call his girlfriend, Mary Elliott, at about 5:30 p.m., 30 minutes after Peaches disappeared. What I found interesting was that Webb asked Mary if she needed anything, but she said no. He then called back at 6:10 p.m. and asked again. This time, she said she had a toothache and needed some medicine, so he picked her up some Excedrin and Oragel and went by her apartment at 6:50 p.m. It was almost as if he was trying to create an alibi. After arriving at Mary's apartment, he says he saw the commotion at Montgomery Village and asked 2 boys what was going on. That's when they told him Peaches was missing. So he said he was going down there and walked into Hazel's apartment while she was being interviewed by police. Strangely, when he entered, he was acting strange, and Hazel noticed his hands were trembling. The police officer who was there left but forgot his baton, and Webb insisted on getting it back to him and left. He returned 15 minutes later and told Hazel he hoped they would find Peaches. He then left again, arriving back at Mary's apartment at 7:30 p.m. with a bag of marijuana and left again 30 minutes later. He returned to her apartment 2 days later and beat Mary up. Mary agreed to take a polygraph and passed, while Webb refused, saying his mother told him never to get hooked up to a machine. On the night Peaches disappeared, Laura Rebecca Moore's 9-year-old daughter saw Peaches come into the laundromat next to the pantry market between 4 p.m. and 5 p.m. When Peaches walked back outside, the girl said she saw her talking to a man in a white Volkswagen. The little girl who saw Peaches was with 30-year-old Kathy Church that day, and she also confirmed the sighting. On December 31st, 1980, 5 days after Peaches went missing, a woman named Faye Skates Ewing, who knew Hazel and Peaches, said she saw her with two black women at a Kroger store on Tazewell Pike. She got behind the girl in line and said Peaches turned and smiled at her. That's when one of the women bent down and whispered something into her ear, causing Peaches to look down at the floor. On January 3rd, a man named Jerry Downs, who was friends with Webb, said that Webb claimed he tossed Peaches' body off Kate's Bridge in South Knox County. Jerry even took a polygraph, and it showed he was being truthful. Police then searched the water of the Little River, but there was no body found. On January 26, 1982, at about 2:30 p.m., Wayne Graham was hunting for rabbits with his 15-year-old son, Michael, in Blount County, near a trash dump when he stumbled upon Peaches' skeletal remains. This area is about 15 minutes by car from the store she disappeared from. She had been strangled to death with a wire. Due to the decomposition, she had to be identified by the clothes she was wearing and her chipped tooth. In 1984, a sex offender by the name of Frank Tate also became a suspect. Frank knew Peaches and her family and was sentenced in 1983 to 10 years in prison for sexual battery of a minor. He was also convicted in 1979 for aggravated sexual battery involving a minor. At the time Peaches disappeared, he was on parole. Residents at the Montgomery Village said that Frank had a reputation for being overly friendly with children. Suspiciously, after Peaches disappeared, he stopped coming around. When questioned about that, he claimed it was just a coincidence and said the real reason he stopped coming around was because he moved from Knox County to Blount County. Inmates in prison also said they felt like Frank was behind her murder, but he hadn't actually confessed to them. Unfortunately, over the years, they've never been able to find enough evidence to arrest a suspect, and as of 2024, this case remains unsolved. Aaron Shane Key was born on April 21, 1977, in Salina, Tennessee, to Earl Randall and Lisa Key and went by the nickname Rabbit. On March 28, 2019, 41-year-old Aaron called his mother Lisa and told her he might have gotten himself into something he couldn't get out of. She told him to pack his stuff and leave, but he said they wouldn't let him. When she asked who, he replied, "The cops." Aaron explained that he was trying to help his cousin, who got busted for the manufacturing of drugs. Allegedly, Aaron was working as a confidential informant and was to report information on the people he was living with. He also told a friend of his named Bobby that if something happened to him, tell his parents he didn't do it and not to let them get away with it. On April 5th, 2019, Aaron decided to move out of his friend Hack Cox's home after he and his girlfriend Karen Webb were having issues. So Hack took Aaron to his uncle's, where his father Earl was. They spent the day together, and around 4:30 a.m., Aaron asked his dad to take him back over there so he could get his belongings and the money back that he had just paid for rent. He told his dad to come back and get him in 30 minutes. After 30 minutes had passed, and Earl was about to head back over there, he received a call telling him that Aaron was dead. When he arrived, he found his son dead on the ground. Russell Cox claimed he performed CPR on him, but the crime scene photos showed Aaron lying on his left side, curled up in a fetal position with a rope around his neck. He also appeared to have had injuries on the right side of his face, and there was a diagonal cut on his face that started just above the eyebrow, in between his eyes, and ended at the corner of his right eye. When investigators arrived, they ruled he had taken his own life and explained the damage to his face on some puppies that were on the property. Allegedly, there were at least 5 people on the property that day who were all drunk, high, or both, and these were the ones giving the officers the information. Interestingly, Aaron's girlfriend, Karen Webb, told people she was initially arrested and charged with capital murder. It remains unclear if she was really arrested. If she was, why did they drop the murder charges? When Lisa went to the funeral home to make arrangements, she asked to see her son, which the mortician agreed to. She strangely found no ligature marks, no rope burns, and no abrasions on his neck at all. However, his nose was broken and his face was severely damaged. She also asked the mortician if he saw anything and he said no. He told Lisa that in his 25 years of business, he had never seen a hanging like this. To his family, it was looking more and more like he was murdered. When Lisa finally got a hold of the crime scene photos, she noticed some very odd things, such as when Earl dropped Aaron off, he was wearing brown tennis shoes, but in the photos, he had on knee-high, lace-up, snake-biter boots that, according to his mother, were unlashed, and his belt was undone. Most of the people at Hack's that day never showed up for the funeral. Karen called the funeral home and told them that she and Aaron were married in an Aryan Brotherhood ceremony, and she wanted him cremated instead. What is the reason for the lie? Was she trying to destroy evidence or something more sinister? A month after Aaron's death, Lisa received a call from a lady who said that she and her boyfriend had talked to her friend Crystal that day, who was allegedly at Hax's residence, and they quoted her as saying she didn't have time to talk because she was busy cleaning up a murder scene. Lisa also went to Hack's home and into the room her son was staying in and noted that the bleach smell was so strong it started burning her nose and eyes, forcing her to step back into the hallway. Allegedly, police never entered the home that night. Also, on the day of Aaron's visitation at the funeral home, a witness overheard a man named Paul Sullivan asking Christy Goolsby and 2 men named Rufus and RJ, who were at Hack's that day, why they did this and put Aaron's family through this. Christy allegedly told him to be quiet, then rolled her window up and sped off. The day before Aaron's death, Rufus had allegedly asked a man named Bud to help him jump Aaron. When asked why, Rufus said that Aaron was a smartass who needed his ass whooped. However, Bud told him they were all family and just needed to talk through it. There's a lot of information from Lisa in this case, and if you're more interested in all the little details, you can check out her Facebook group called Justice for Aaron Shane Key. I feel like I've covered the highlights and enough information to show that Aaron might have been caught up in something he couldn't get out of and was murdered for it. You can even look at this photo here of the rope and wonder to yourself, how in the world would he have tied that up there without a ladder? What do y'all think? Was Aaron murdered for being an informant, or did he really take his own life? Let me know your thoughts in the comments below. Unfortunately, the case was closed on October 13th, 2020, and as of 2024, Lisa continues to seek justice for her son Aaron. Adriana Nicole Wicks was born on January 14, 2002 to Jennifer Wicks. In 2004, 2-year-old Adriana was living in Cross Plains, Tennessee with her mother and her mother's boyfriend, William Joseph Benton. They were living in a house on Joey's parents' property in the Owens Chapel community in Robertson County. On March 24, 2004, 21-year-old Jennifer called her mother, Kathy Nail, upset over an argument she and Joey had. The next day, March 25th at 11 a.m., she called and spoke with her father, Michael, who lives in Manchester, Tennessee. During that call, she told her father that she had been arguing with the Benton family. After hanging up with him, she nor Adriana has ever been heard from again. By March 27th, 2004, when there was still no word from Jennifer, Kathy reported her missing. Kathy said that her daughter was very close with the family and kept in contact, sometimes calling multiple times a day. When investigators questioned Joey, he initially said that Jennifer and Adriana had left with a friend he didn't know on March 25th, the same day she spoke with her father. He later changed his story and said that he and Jennifer had an argument on March 24th, and afterward, she asked him to take her and her daughter to a grocery store called Food Value in Cross Plains. After that, he said he dropped them off at an Exxon gas station near Exit 112 off Interstate 65 in Cross Plains. He said after about 5 to 10 minutes, a white four-door, early 1990s, mid-sized car pulled up and they got in. Joey then claimed that she showed back up the next afternoon without Adriana in the same white car she was picked up in, asking for her income tax return. Joey says his parents weren't home at the time to give her the money, so she left and never returned. Investigators have never been able to confirm any of Joey's stories. Over the years, the Benton property has been searched several times, but no signs of Jennifer and Adriana were found. While the case was initially listed as a missing persons case, in 2013, it was reclassified as a homicide, with Joey remaining a person of interest. Sadly, as of 2024, Jennifer and Adriana have never been found, and this case remains unsolved. Kirsten Joy Kerchak was born on November 16, 1982, to Robert and Karen and grew up in northern Indiana. Kirsten was said to love her mom's ragu spaghetti and strawberry-flavored ice cream. Unfortunately, Robert and Karen divorced, which took a massive toll on Kirsten. By 13 years old, she was using drugs and sneaking out of the house. At the age of 16, Kirsten moved to Memphis, Tennessee, to live with her father, who had relocated there after the divorce. However, moving to Tennessee didn't help the situation. Once there, she enrolled at White Station High School, but dropped out before graduating. She continued using drugs, so her father put her in drug rehab twice, but it didn't take and he was forced to kick her out of the house. Even as the drug use continued, she still kept in touch with her family. Around Christmas of 2000, 18-year-old Kirsten traveled back to Indiana to visit family, but spent part of the time looking for drugs and the other part with her mother and sister, Ashley. After Christmas, she traveled back to Memphis, where her boyfriend, Brent Wolverton, was. Brent played in a local band called Interstate and had only known Kirsten for less than a year. On New Year's Eve 2000, she and Brent, along with another band member named Josh Anders, went to a New Year's party in Midtown that the band was performing at, which was not far from Brent's apartment on Clark Place. Brent was in charge of the lights for the band, and Kirsten was sitting with him. However, she was high on drugs and kept messing with the lights. Brent became agitated and took Kirsten outside and told her not to act like this was a strip club. He saw her again, still outside, at about 3:30 a.m. Another band member by the name of Bradford Tolan, who went by Tolly, had a brother named Bobby with an apartment in Midtown. Allegedly, Josh ended up on Bobby's couch and was woken up by Kirsten at 10 a.m. asking for a ride. He agreed, but his car wouldn't start, so he borrowed Tolly's blue 1988 Ford Aerostar van with a Kentucky license plate. First, they allegedly went for breakfast at CK's coffee shop and then went back to Josh's apartment, where he showered and changed clothes. While he was doing that, she allegedly stayed in the van with the heater running so she could stay warm. She then wanted to find a house, I'm assuming to get more drugs, so they drove around for 4 or 5 more hours into the bad parts of West Memphis. They first went to a big house that was set far back off the road, and she told him it belonged to either her mom or grandparents, but she said nobody would be home. So they continued on going from house to house, but according to Josh, it was never the right place. They eventually gave up and headed to Brent's apartment. He said they drove around for so long that he had to fill the van up twice. He also said she tried to put the moves on him by dancing in her seat, but he claims he shot her down. By the time they got back to Brent's, it was already dark. Josh said that when he got out to see if Brent was home, he left Kirsten inside with the heater running and walked to the front door. That's when he claims she drove off in the van. Brent backed this story up initially, but later changed his story. His new story said that both Josh and Tolly were driving around that day with her. He said one of them called him at 2 p.m. and said that she stole the van while they were getting gas. Either way, she was never seen again after that day, and the van has never been located. When Tolly was questioned in the case, he claimed he reported the van stolen, but investigators could never find proof of this. Since Brent saw her at 3:30 a.m. and Josh saw her at 10 a.m., where was she between that time? Josh would later say that he believed she sold the van for drugs, while Brent thought she might have run off to California. When reporters reached out to the men years later, the only one who seemed annoyed by the contact was Tolly. Reporters had reached out to his mother, trying to find a way to contact him. When he called them back, he said, "What if I wanted to go find your mother's phone number and then hung up on them?" Josh, on the other hand, suspiciously acts like he isn't sure who Kirsten is, but finally says, "That name sounds familiar." Unfortunately, without the van or a body, investigators haven't been able to prove a crime actually took place. In 2008, the case was passed over to the Homicide Division, but there is still no progress. Several people allegedly told a friend of Kirsten's that she is definitely dead, which makes me wonder, did she overdose and it was covered up? Let me know what you think in the comments below. Sadly, as of 2024, Kirsten has never been found, and this case remains unsolved. In June of 2023, 21-year-old Layla Santinello was going through a rough time in her life and had just lost custody of her 2-year-old daughter. She then had a falling out with her boyfriend, left their home, and began staying on the couches of friends before finally ending up at the AmeriCourt Motel on June 25, 2023. Their falling out was due to him finding out about another man she had been secretly seeing on the side. She had even stayed with the new guy for a couple of nights after leaving her boyfriend. Her mother, Jennifer, had no clue anything was wrong until her boyfriend sent her a message on June 24th asking if Layla was in jail or the hospital because he couldn't find her. However, later that same night, Layla sent her mom a message saying she was okay and had been with a friend and didn't have a phone. The boyfriend continued reaching out to people on social media looking for her, but didn't report her missing because he was out on bond and worried he would get into trouble. On June 26, 2023, other guests at the AmeriCourt saw Layla going from door to door in a state of distress. Numerous strangers offered her help, but she declined. She then got into an altercation with an unknown individual. By midday, due to the commotion, the motel was threatening to kick her out, so she ran barefoot into the nearby woods. 5 different employees at a nearby warehouse could see Layla in the woods that day. After that, she was caught on surveillance footage walking toward the Kingsport Greenbelt. This is the last confirmed sighting of Layla. A potential sighting of her occurred at Marble Slab Creamery the following day, but that is an eyewitness account, and those are notoriously inaccurate. The person seen at the ice cream shop asked to use a worker's phone and then left, telling them she was going across to the nearby Five Below to buy some flip-flops. Since this cannot be confirmed, June 26 is being used as her last known sighting. The private investigator that was hired by her father and stepmother posted on November 20, 2023, that he spoke with the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation and decided that the marble slab sighting was not credible. Come to find out, that lead was provided by Layla's boyfriend, Michael, who she was in the process of breaking up with. After being reported missing, her family spent days searching for her before finally getting a sliver of hope on July 10th when her stepmother, Brittany, received a strange Cash App request from her account. The request was for $97, and in the subject line, it was TWLMG, which stands for They Won't Let Me Go. She sent a dollar back asking if she was okay, but there was no response. She contacted the police, but also continued sending messages trying to confirm if it was Layla by asking personal questions such as, "What's your baby brother's birthday?" But again, no response. Random requests for money would continue to come through and were more and more threatening. One request was for $95 and said, "For 15 minutes or you'll find her in pieces." Those messages continued in that manner before investigators were finally able to track down the person and determine the whole thing was a hoax. The person sending the message was a friend of Layla's, and considering how cruel this joke is, it shows you the type of friend she was hanging around. Investigators searched the person's home, but there were no signs of Layla. Her mother, Jennifer, believes her daughter might have been abducted by sex traffickers, while her stepmother, Brittany, believes she might have overdosed while with friends and they disposed of her body. Unfortunately, as of 2024, she has never been found, and this case remains unsolved. Thanks for joining me today on Southern Girl Crime Stories. Please be sure to check out my YouTube channel for these stories, along with photos of victims, suspects, location of murders, and more. As always, your support is very much appreciated, and I look forward to seeing y'all next time.